So this one's super heavy. So it's a crystal, but it just like is an amazing fidget. But also like I've been learning more about just like sounds so woo-woo, but the like they all have like an electronic energy to them. And so I learned that I didn't even know it. I just love this one, but it's all about like building up your creativity. And I just love it because it's heavy for proprioceptive input, and then I can fidget with it.
So, I was recording that. Hi, everybody. Dana did not know I was recording that, but
Shenanigans, full of shenanigans.
before we started, she said, I gotta do my oils or something. I don't even know what she was saying. I said, well, wait till we start and do it then so that people can see what you're doing. And she said, no. And anyhow, is that cool that I leave that in?
That's totally fine.
Okay.
I'm gonna finish my oils then, since we're recording.
Well,
So,
this is
yeah.
Dana Abraham, everybody. Welcome back. My name is Seth Perler with the TFOS, the Executive Function Online Summit. It is 94 degrees today. The room that I'm in does not have access to air conditioning. So if I start looking hot during this session, it's probably because I am. So hello,
Don't know
welcome
if I've
back.
ever been on a conference with someone who introduces themselves as hot.
I did not mean it metaphorically. I meant literally, temperature-wise. So this is Dana Abraham, and I've known Dana not for very long, for just a few months, but what I've known about her has been really impressive to me. And Dana is somebody who really focuses in helping students who struggle with sensory issues. Now, I know a lot about sensory issues, but just barely enough to be dangerous. But I do know enough about sensory issues to know that it has a massive impact on students. So all the students I work with, I do know that there are times when I notice things with sensory issues that I can pick up on, but I'm not super attuned to it, but I'll be like, oh, and then I bring it up with them and we work with that because it's super important. I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole now because that is Dana's job in a little bit. So I also know Dana from a bundle of products that we did with a bunch of people recently. And the reason I'm telling you parents this right now is just because her work ethic and her dedication and her commitment is incredible. So I'm really excited to hear and go down the rabbit hole in terms of the sensory stuff because I've seen her work ethic in this other area. I cannot wait to see how much I know that she's nerded out on this stuff for years because if she applies half of her nerdiness to to the sensory stuff, she's really going to teach us some incredible stuff. So welcome, Dana.
Thank you. Thank you for that awkward but yet amazing intro.
You're so welcome.
am super excited to be here. I'm really excited. I've been watching you from afar, and so getting to know you even more over the last couple of weeks has been amazing, and I'm learning so much just in the short time that I've been friends with you. So
Good, good. Thank you for saying that. I hope my mic is in properly. Okay.
I can hear you.
Should be, I know, but I want the good audio. Wow, people are seeing all kinds of unedited stuff today, which is good. So hi. So Dana, who are you outside of work?
Okay, so we were talking about that, and I was like, I don't know who I am outside of work, but I'll start with the simplest. I am Dana Abraham, and I was born and raised in Little Rock, Arkansas. So as we talk and I start talking about kids or doing any role playing, you will hear that Southern accent and charm come out, even though I live in Chicago now. And I have three amazing kids. I call kids super kids. So I have three amazing super kids. I have a 14-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 6-year-old. And my 14-year-old is the one that the outside world would call challenging. And I like to call him challenging because he's challenged me to be a better parent and to learn all of the things that I've learned over the last 14 years. I was a teacher before I became an online educator and blogger and author. And I was in the classroom for 15 years before my son no longer fit in the public school setting. And I homeschooled against my will after realizing that he just wasn't going to fit
Are
very
you
well.
glad you did that?
Although I never was one of those people that just was like born to be a homeschooler. Like it wasn't something that I was like, yeah, I want to stay home with my kids. And like that, there are some of my friends that are amazing at that, and that just wasn't me. So I definitely struggled with that. And then my son was going through his biggest transitions of trying to figure out what was going on and trying to help him, you know, be his best self. And I don't think we could have done that if I had not homeschooled. So I think we are where we are today because of that 3-year stint of homeschooling.
And do you think that, I'm going to go off track a tiny bit here, but do you think that that homeschooling is doable for somebody who's really intimidated by it?
Yes, 100%. That's why I got into blogging, was because when I Googled, you know, one, my son's behaviors, but also homeschooling, basically Google told me I was a bad parent when I started checking out his behaviors and things like that, despite having the education background. And people would say, oh, well, you're an educator, so you'll do okay. And really, it was forgetting what I knew in the classroom and then really just starting from scratch. And so we actually unschooled for a long time to get rid of all the habits he had learned in the public school setting and what the world had taught him about who he was. And then we started really getting in the academics and things like that once he had that confidence built back up and he understood himself more.
Interesting, because one of the themes that many of the speakers talk about in general is, you're talking about a transition in homeschooling, but the transition, in fact, Carly Rae, I don't know if you know her, but she was talking about when they transition kids into the school, they have a school where kids aren't being successful in public school, and they're in Montana, and these kids come, but the whole first phase of it is sort of unlearning stuff and really setting the nervous system, essentially resetting the nervous system. So I asked that too, because, Debbie Reber was just saying how she thinks that she was so overwhelmed or nervous about homeschooling, but how anybody can do it. It's not easy, but that you
can. It's not easy, but anyone can. And you forget that when kids are in school, what they're getting done in 6-8 hours in a classroom, you can get done in like an hour at home. And then you have the rest of the day to go do whatever you want. So that part's pretty cool.
That's a really good point too. And you're not constrained by many things, but one of the things you're not constrained by is a schedule that's dictated by subject. So if your kid is really getting into math and the train is going and it can go for 2.5 hours, take that train. But we have schools where we say 45 minutes, bell rings, go to the next thing, shift your brain, you know, and that's not reality. Or if you're doing a project-based thing and you're doing different disciplines within the project, and it's a day where your kid gets obsessed with the project, like I did with this conference about a week and a half ago. I spent about 10 hours in it. I just happened to have the energy and the executive function that day. But anyhow, you don't have the constraints.
Yeah. And I found that to be really helpful, especially, you know, and I could let my kid lay on the floor to do his homework. We could go outside. We could do it in 5-minute stints. We could do it in 2-hour stints. It really didn't matter. And I think that that's one of the freedoms that you forget about when you go to homeschool.
Cool. So professionally.
Yeah. So professionally,
I wanted to hear where you taught for 15 years and what age and what subjects or grades?
Awesome. Yeah. So I taught the gamut of early childhood. I started in Arizona the day after 9/11 and taught 1 year there in an overflow kindergarten classroom. So I got all the kids that the other kindergarten classrooms didn't want because their classrooms were too big. And so then that was my very first year of teaching. It's 35 kids in an open schoolroom. So I learned a lot about differences.
Throw you to the sharks, huh?
Yeah, they just threw me right in. And then moved to Chicago, and that was, if I thought my first year was hard, I taught on the west side of Chicago in a really, really rough neighborhood, bars on the windows, like drugs in the, you know, garden, and you couldn't even use the playground because there were syringes in the playground. Like, it was rough. It was a really rough neighborhood.
And what was one of the things you learned about what kids need in that situation? Because my first teaching experiences was on the Navajo Indian Reservation, where kids are struggling with a lot of probably similar issues, and I learned so much
They just need connection. Yeah. Like they just need someone who's not going to try to fix them or change them or tell them that they're broken or something's wrong with them. They just need someone to be there, to hear them, to make them feel valued. And if you can't do that, you're not going to get them to learn anything.
So good.
Yeah. And so that I taught on the west side for quite a few years and then moved to the south side of Chicago where I taught preschool. So I taught three and then I grew with those kids and taught them as 4-year-olds. And then I actually started the gifted kindergarten in that school. And I was the first classroom that had those. Those kids just graduated high school. And one of my kids is going to Vanderbilt, which is really exciting. Awesome. So taught gifted for a year. I thought that was going to be my new direction, but I ended up in a different school setting in a dual language school. I taught in the English classrooms, but 90% of my kids didn't speak English and I don't speak any Spanish. So that was definitely interesting. And I taught preschool and I taught first grade there. And when I taught preschool, that's where I started. That was the first time I started learning about some of the differences. And I had first heard about sensory processing because I was in a blended preschool classroom and we had 20 kids and 14 of them were typically developing and six had IEPs and 504s and all of that. And they had a specialized teacher just for them in the classroom and we co-taught. And one of the parents came in and said, here's my son. And when he starts to like not be able to sit still and when he starts to get upset, you need to wrap him up in this like blanket. And I was like, what? Like, what are you talking about, woman? And so she told me about sensory processing disorder and I started reading about it. And that was the first time that I read Out of Sync Child. Mm-hmm. And I read that as my summer read. And I was like, this is my son. This is my son. This is my, like, the more that I was like, oh my goodness. Like, it was just like the heavens parted and the light came down and it was like, ah, but.
And that's an old book, but that was it's a classic. Yeah. If there is such a thing of a classic in this field of complicated kids, it is a must read, I think.
It's a must read. It is, you know, it's got a lot of like science, but you know, Carol wrote it for parents because she needed something to be able to explain, you know, this really complicated thing at the time. And I wasn't taught it as a teacher. I wasn't taught it as a special, you know, in a special ed classroom. I wasn't taught it as a parent. And so, you know, here I am with this kiddo who is touching everything, who is like has zero impulse control, who's constantly moving, who's getting sick all the time because he's always putting things in his mouth. And like reading that, I was like, oh my goodness, like there's a reason he does all this. I'm not just a terrible parent. So that was the start of my journey of learning about differences and all the things that are underneath the iceberg. And I know you teach about the iceberg theory. That's something we talk about a lot in our program too, but that there's so many more things. And so I started learning, well, if I'm missing sensory processing, then what else is there? And I learned about executive functioning. And I feel like that opened up a whole nother world again. I was like, wait a second, this explains so much more. And there's such a good overlap there of explaining, you know, behaviors that we see and get frustrated with kids that none of us are taught. And I think that's why it's become so exciting for me to share that with people.
So one of the things in your experience that's similar to mine, I mean, I worked with very different kids than you, but both of us have had very, very different experiences with different types of kids, different ages of kids, different abilities of kids. We've had a really diverse range where we've worked with kids. And in terms of some of the sensory stuff, which we haven't really defined yet, but in terms of some of the sensory stuff, like one of the things for me, the gift of working with, like some teachers will teach fourth grade for 17 years. Mm-hmm. And they really get used to getting really honed in and good and gifted at this one. But we have had, I think we've had the gift of learning, not necessarily to pinpoint one area like that, but we've had so many that we see commonalities between all kids. Yes. So I know I would describe it differently, and that's not relevant in this talk. But for you, you start getting it, going down this sensory rabbit hole, and you start learning. So what have you learned that about sensory stuff that you're like, oh, that year one, these kids were experiencing it, year 15 and all these kids that seem so different. What are some of the, I'm trying to think of the way to say it, but some of the key overarching things about sensory stuff that all kids.
Yeah. So one of the,
but no.
Yeah. So one of the biggest things about sensory that I've learned is that you know about sensory processing if you have a kid who has a diagnosis. Like once you've gotten some sort of diagnosis like ADHD or autism, or somehow you've gotten an amazing OT or child psychiatrist who has diagnosed with SPD, then, which is sensory processing.
Yeah, disorder. And say what OT is too.
Yeah, and OT is occupational therapy. So let's say you've gone down that rabbit hole and you've gotten some diagnoses. Now you're going to learn about it. But otherwise, like my friends, I go to a party or I, you know, meet other people who are my age with kids or other teachers, they have no idea what it is. And they're just now starting to teach it a little bit in schools and, you know, schools for teachers and schools for, you know, for therapists and things like that. But they don't really, it's not well known. And one of the things that I wish I had known is just that we were told a lie. We were told we have 5 senses and we don't. We have like upwards of 21. And we have 8 that we use on a day-to-day basis, all of us, that affect the ins and outs of our everyday life. And so you've got your basic 5 that we all know about, but we are taught that that's just how you learn about the world, right? Is that you smell things, you see things, you feel things, you taste things. And touch things. Thank you. And that's how you learn about the world. That's kind of how we learn about our senses, is that's what they're used for. We don't talk about how that's how you interpret the world and that you have an overreactive or an underreactive, you know, any of those 5 senses. So a kid who is constantly agitated in a classroom could be constantly agitated because you have a loud, busy, and over posterized classroom, and they're just overwhelmed because their visual sense is just like, whoa, what is happening here? Or their auditory sense. And so you're getting a kid who's constantly distracted, who's like looking this way and looking that way, and someone just whispers and now they're suddenly in another conversation. And it's because their ears are hearing every little thing that's happening. It's not just that they are lazy or that they don't want to focus and that if they tried harder that they could, you know, they could get it. And it's just all these little nuances that even as adults, like, I don't know about you. I always do this with people. Do you love or hate roller coasters?
Love.
Love, right? So you love movement, right? Your vestibular
pressure sense, of it. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So you're seeking that vestibular movement, whereas when I was a kid, I sought it out. Like I was constantly moving. I loved roller coasters, but as a kid, and your senses do change as you, and they evolve as you get older. And I can't go on a roller coaster. I get sick just sitting in the front seat of a car. Like I want to, but I get so sick now. And that's my vestibular sense. And we don't talk about that. So if you've got a kid who's constantly running around the classroom, constantly moving, rocking in their chair, pushing back in their chair, like spinning. All those things. Yeah, spinning. Yes, swinging. Another one is,
well, you didn't define vestibular.
Yeah.
So for people who've never heard it, even heard that word, yeah, just briefly.
Yeah. So vestibular is context. Your sense of movement through space, right? So, and then your proprioceptive, which is the other sense, is, that a lot of people don't talk about. And I used to not even be able to say the word, but proprioceptive is your body awareness. So where you are in space.
Yeah, it allows me to be able to, for example, do this or this.
Yes, absolutely. So I was actually watching one of those like brain games. It's like a show for kids. Have you heard of it? Mm-hmm. And they had this game where the parents had to close their eyes and just walk a straight line or stand still or... Hold on, I'm trying to think. Oh, they had to close their eyes, put their arms out, and just hop in space. And then the kids had to do the exact same thing. And then when they opened their eyes, the parents had moved a ton and the kids were right in space.
Interesting.
And it was because they had a kid whose proprioceptive sense was responsive, and the as you age, your proprioceptive sense becomes less responsive.
Wow.
And so then the parent had moved a ton. But we have kids who have that under and over responsiveness as well. So you've got a kid who's leaning or pushing or putting their head on their desk constantly. Like that can be low tone, meaning they're like stomach muscles aren't strong, but it also can be that they are seeking that pushing and that proprioceptive movement so they can feel where their body is in space.
So at this point, as I listen to you, what's overwhelming to me is that there's no structure to this yet. So parents, don't worry. We'll get to that. But I'm like sitting here thinking, well, how do I even know where to start? Because mm-hmm. I can like imagine, for example, a kid who's always, I can think of one right now. She always, at my office, she always wants to sit on the ground. Not mm-hmm. the couches, not the desk. There's something about that mm-hmm. I'm guessing that is a sensory thing. For me, you know, I'm a car drove by, I notice it. I hear something, I know. So if you watch me as I'm doing these interviews, you'll notice I'm very much like squirrel, 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 because I don't filter well. Mm-hmm. And that has been a problem my whole life. Like I take in everything. My ears take in everything to an annoying degree. Mm-hmm. So for like people who get to know me very well and they're like, why are you bothered by that? And it's like, it's not the thing that's bothering me. It's just that it's kind of hard to explain. I don't filter it out and it's hard to focus on what I want to be focusing on because I'm not choosing the distractions. Mm-hmm. I don't have the mechanism that sort of filters them. Sorry, did I get off on a tangent or are we good?
A little bit. No, not really. It's good though.
So I want to know eventually.
It was overwhelming, like where to start.
I want to know eventually where to start. Before we get there, mm-hmm. What is your superpower as far as working with families or kids or teachers or people who don't get it? And you take them from point A where they don't even know about it. They don't know how it's impacting them to point B where they've known enough to be dangerous. They've really turned some corners and things are not perfect, but a lot better. What's your superpower and what is that journey?
So I think one of my superpowers is the ability to take the different pieces that I've learned on my journey and put it in a nice, easy to follow system that incorporates what is under the surface, and sensory is just one of the pieces under the surface. And so, you know, focusing on that understanding piece, but we talked about earlier, you said, wait, what is the one thing you learned in all of the classrooms you were in? And I said, connection. And that is like one of the primary keys that you have to start with is connection uh-huh. and making sure that kids are connected. And so in our framework, we talk about how to really build authentic connections with our kids, and then how to truly understand what's going on under the surface, everything from triggers to sensory preferences to executive functioning needs or their skills that they might be lacking, and their fight, flight, or freeze, like automatic responses. And then that final piece, which I think you do really well, is that empowerment piece. Like you have to get the kids on board. You have to give them ownership in it. You have to teach them how their own body works. Because you're not as bothered by some of the things you do because you're like, this is how I work and this is who I am. And we have to teach our kids to be that way too, to say, okay, I am distracted by noises, so I might need headphones if I want to focus. If it's not bothering me, I might not need headphones. So we're teaching our kids to recognize their own sensory preferences, their own triggers, their own things, so that they can self-regulate and they can self-advocate and they can say, hey, you know what? I'm done. This place is loud. There's a lot of people and I'm no longer comfortable. Can I go to the car and read my book, listen to my book or whatever? So that's kind of what the journey looks like, is taking parents and teachers through that process of taking everything they know and helping them become an expert in their own kid, and then helping the kid become an expert in themselves.
Awesome. Somebody else said being an investigator for your kid. Somebody else said a detective. This sounds like along the same lines, like the more we know, the more we can help them. And I want to mention, well, or I'll let you mention the, I'll kind of start it off where I'm going here, but the opposite side of the coin, when people don't know and a kid is experiencing sensory issues, then, you know, they may be acting out, or they may be, they may not have the words to say, my sensory system is completely overwhelmed right now. I need to do something to address that. You know, I need to leave the room for a few minutes. There are too many kids to, you know, for example, project time during a classroom where kids are all, you know, and I think there are a lot of mistakes that we make and when we don't understand. So what are some of the common mistakes parents and teachers make when they don't know that that's going on beneath the tip of the iceberg?
Yeah, so I think just one is just naming it as defiant or rude or disrespectful, or, you know, just this very, like, and it comes from a good place. It
absolutely
really does. It comes from a, okay, like, I'm trying to teach you how to be respectful, how to be independent, how to be successful in this world, and you're not listening, and you're not following instructions, and I'm tired of the bad behavior. And I see that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just working with one of my, one student in our free Facebook group yesterday, and she was saying, you know, every time I leave the house, my son ends up, you know, just kicking me, yelling, and getting upset. And I'm like, okay, well, first, is it actually every time? Because sometimes we like to group everything together and say that everything happens and we miss the wins. We miss those small positive moments. And so I think that that's a big mistake that happens too, is you generalize and you say, okay, we can never go out in public. We can never have friends over. My kid never listens. My kid never sits down. So that's one. And then two is, you know, she said, no, I think it is a lot of times when we go out of the house, when we're in the house, it's fine. I'm like, okay, great. So that gives you a clue that when you are going out of the house, something is overwhelming for your kid. If we believe that all behavior is communication, then something is setting your kid off. And she's like, okay, but his behavior is still so bad. I look like a bad parent. And I look like I don't know what I'm doing. I'm like, that's the crux of it, though, is that you're placing so much meaning on that behavior. Like it's something that they're doing to you. And it's not. It's like the Carly Simon song. You know, you probably think this song is about you, right? It's, you know, you probably think this behavior is about you, but it's like 10 times out of, you know, 11, it's not about you at all. And so it might be about your reaction to them, but it's not necessarily directed at you. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the things, is just to remain calm and say, okay, what is my child trying to tell me? And then just start going through a process of elimination and asking. I think we forget to ask our kids. So we just want to like throw all the Pinterest tricks at them and all the tools and strategies. And we want to fix it because we don't want our kids to be in pain, or we don't want to be embarrassed. But then we're afraid to actually ask them, like, okay, well, I notice when we go out of, you know, outside, you start kicking me and getting upset, and I'm trying to figure out why. Can you help me figure out what is bothering you? The next time we leave the house, can you pay attention to what things start to bother you? And that's when a kid will be like, well, it's loud here, or there's too many people here, or I didn't know we were going to go to so many places. Like my husband can go to like 3 shops and then he is out, whereas I could shop all day long. But it's recognizing where your threshold is. Mm-hmm. And teaching our kids to recognize that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Did I go on a tangent? I think.
Oh my gosh. I could have gone on 17 side tangents from what you said. I'm not going to go into all of them, but the first one was is an executive function thing, is transitioning, which mm-hmm. could also be thought of as flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
So the kid has to, or shifting, the kid has to shift. Their brain's on one train and you're about to get in the car and go somewhere. They have to shift, and it for you might be easy. But for that, you might be like, need to grab my keys, need to grab my wallet, need to grab my phone, need to make sure gas is in the car, grab my coat if it's cold out, let's go. You know, mm-hmm. but for them, that might be a lot of shifting mentally to sort of
yes.
that.
Yes. And then when you add
several things I could have spoken about, but Sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, when you put both issues together, when you put both both lenses together, the lens of looking at things from an executive function side and looking at it from a sensory side, it's not one or the other. They go together really, really well. And so that transition piece and that flexibility piece, if you're really comfortable in a quiet, calm house, and then you've got to transition to a warm, hot car, and then with like a different setting and different noises, and then you've got to transition to a school with lots of noises and lots of smells and lots of people and all of the different things going on, then that transition and flexibility is going to be difficult as well. So they go hand in hand, I think.
One of the things that I've been interested in for a long time is sort of is like evolutionary biology type stuff. But one of the things that I think might be important, I haven't even gotten to asking you about executive function yet, but we'll get there. But one of the things that I think is important to recognize is that we live in a world unlike any we have ever lived in human history. We did not used to have electricity, so our circadian rhythms were different because we would have never had lights on at night. We may have light by fire or candle, but that's the most light we would ever see at night, ever, up until very short time ago in human history. We would have never walked down a street and seen hundreds or thousands. I was in New York City the other week, thousands of people in a day, or tens of thousands. Like, we would have seen 50, 100, 200 people at most in a day. We would have never had electronics vying for our attention, or phones or alerts, or so our senses are bombarded now.
Yep.
And there's a great saying that says, just because we're used to, I forget, a brilliant saying, just because we're used to a dysfunctional world doesn't mean that it's a good thing for us, or something like that. But I know I botched that one. But the point is it's important to recognize that as we're helping our kids navigate this world, our body, our biology, our makeup as a mammal is kind of freaking out and overwhelmed. So our
And just think, even just in the last 30 years, right? Like many of our families would have lived on farms. We would have done the chores in the morning. We would have lifted huge buckets of water and carried them to the animals. We would have like shoveled the hay, and all of that is giving our body input that we just don't give it anymore. I mean, even in schools, like my daughter was talking about being in first grade, and she's super excited because now she gets to do the monkey bars. She wasn't allowed to do them in kindergarten because it's just not safe. And she's not allowed to walk up the slide because it's just not safe. And my fifth grader was like, yeah. And last year, because we were in fifth grade, we got to sit on top of the monkey bars. And I was just thinking about, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that I was in like the grand scheme of things, that I was in first grade and kindergarten, and I was hanging upside down on the monkey bars in kindergarten, and I was doing tire swings. And yeah, I got hurt. I have scars to prove it, but I got so much more input than I used to in that way.
And does that matter?
Yeah. Why does that matter? Because then we put our kids in a classroom. And I know we're talking a lot about executive functioning, and we're talking about being able to focus and have attention. And we're talking about being able to plan and, you know, being able to organize our world. And what happens when we get sensory input, especially proprioceptive input and vestibular input, it organizes our body, and it helps us kind of align our body so that we can attend for longer, focus on one thing. We can organize our thoughts and plan things out. And we're missing that piece to our day with many, many of our kids.
So thank you for wrapping that up. So just to connect those dots for you watching this, everybody, I just want to really make it so clear the importance developmentally of these things that we don't have as much access to, and the interference from things we do have access to. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, now let's a little bit get into. So in terms of sensory stuff, or in terms of your life, or in terms of kids you're working with, how do you define executive function? Let's try one sentence, or just short
We were talking about this. I let you be the executive function expert. so, I mean, I think
well,
I
just how is it related?
So executive functions is, you know, your ability to do things on a day-to-day basis. So it's your ability to get through your day-to-day life. That's the way that I would explain it to a friend of mine who knows nothing about executive functions. And so it's using, you know, a notepad and highlighting pens. It's doing post-it notes when I'm organizing anything. And, you know, it's being able to focus for a long amount of time. And with our kiddos with sensory processing, it's that, it's really that impulse control stuff. So a lot of our kiddos who are under responsive and are seeking vestibular movement, or they're seeking tactile input and they're touching, they don't have the executive function skills yet to stop that impulse and say, but I want to touch it, but I need to taste it. I used to have a little girl in my classroom who would take a crayon, she'd pick it up and she would smell it and then lick it and then put it down. So not only was she seeking the sensory input, she didn't have the executive function skills to stop herself from doing something that other people might see as inappropriate. And so that wasn't a one sentence, but.
No, that's great. That's great. That's great. So it sounds a lot. I had somebody else on who was talking about that. What she was talking about was before you can even get to execute, you have to be dealing with these. And it sounds very similar with the sensory stuff. Before you're able to be able to focus, pay attention, organize, manage time, do the things that you need to do to execute on the important things that they need to get done in a given day, you have to have your sensory, or would you call them base needs? Is it?
I think it's just your sensory needs.
You have to have your sensory
needs. You have your basic needs, and then you need your sensory needs met. You know, so food, water, sleep, all those things are your basic needs, and then your sensory needs.
And when your sensory system is overwhelmed or underwhelmed, I'll ask about that.
Either one, yeah, you can see it either place.
Then that's going to impact your ability to execute. So it sort of really, really is beneath the surface in terms of. Okay, so let me ask you this. So I just said, what did I say? Over and under what?
Over and under responsive. Yeah.
So what Dana's teaching, a lot of this, I just know a little bit about, so I'm really excited to learn about this. So what is over? It sounds like those are, did you want to go down and teach us in more of a linear way, or do you mind? Or do
whatever, you want to, wherever this takes us, I'm totally fine with
and
that.
And at the end, I'll ask you if you left any key things out that you want people to know. I will not forget that question. So we have over and under responsiveness. And then I guess we can consider that there's such a thing as like a baseline responsiveness, which means that they'll be able to execute.
Yes.
So what is over and under responsiveness?
I just want to clarify. So I am not a doctor and I do not have any occupational therapy background. I've learned all this through books and real life experience. So one of my superpowers is being able to bridge the scientific talk into everyday real life talk. And I do so much of the everyday real life talk now that I might not say it exactly scientifically. So I just want to like,
so for those OTs out there that are,
yes. So okay. For any of you guys out there that are my fact finders and that's your superpower and you can remember like researchers and developer, all that stuff, you're not going to get that from me. So I'm just going to
The purpose of this summit is for a parent who's just looking to understand the principles rather than the nitty gritty. So okay. How can we help our kids?
So under responsive means that you're not receiving enough of that sort of sensory input. And so your body is looking for it. So this might be, like I said earlier, if you are under responsive to proprioceptive input, it means that it takes more of it for you to feel it or notice that you have it. So you're going to be pushing on things. You're going to be breaking a ton of, you're probably like really destructive. You're breaking your pencils. You're destroying your toys really easily. You're seen as the hitter or the pusher. You're a leaner. And my son used to actually just put his head on the floor and just like wheelbarrow it across the floor because he was trying to get some input that he wasn't getting. It was harder for him to notice it.
Are these chewers too?
And we call the, a lot of times they're called seekers. So if it's under responsive, you are seeking that input.
Got it.
Sense? So a chewer would be a tact, it's actually many things. That's what's crazy about chewers is that you have proprioceptive from the jaw, from your, so the chewing. So it could be that they're seeking proprioceptive input. They could be seeking olfactory or oral input with their mouth. Or it could be tactile because there's so many tactile senses inside the mouth. So it could be a combination of those. And that's why when people say, oh, my kid's a thumb sucker or my kid is a chewer, you'll notice that they don't all chew the same things. So some kids will put their fingers way back in the back of their mouth. Some kids will use their strings on their shirt. Some kids will use pins. Some kids will just chew anything. And so it's when you just stop to say, okay, where are they chewing and what are they maybe trying to get out of this? And what could replace that instead of their clothes? So for my son, gum or a long straw works for him, but those chewy necklaces he doesn't like because he doesn't put things on the front of his mouth.
And that is such an area where I could see, like, if somebody's chewing on their finger way back in their mouth, somebody's saying, stop doing that. That's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. And not well-intended adults, mm-hmm. just not connect. So glad to hear this talk because yeah. I just think there's probably so many applications. Now, are there seekers for visual and auditory? At so night, if I want a fan on, is that seeking? And
yeah, so seeking would be under responsive. So any kid who struggles to get off their electronics, who's constantly looking for, like they prefer to read graphic novels instead of regular, just lined novels. You've got, you know, maybe kids who are seeking out bright colors, they're seeking out just loud environments. But at the same time, those kids can still get overstimulated and need to avoid some of that at the same time. So you can have both of them at the same
time. Okay, so somebody is not just a seeker, which is under what?
Under-responsive.
Under-responsive seeks, over-responsive.
Mm-hmm. Avoids.
Avoids.
Yeah.
But so if you're one person can do both at different yes. times. I know that I can do that. Like I yes. can go to a concert and love it. And after a while, I'll be like, I cannot take this anymore. I don't yes. care that I paid $100. I'm out of here.
And that's, and it's like, it's exactly like that. It's like taking a Coke can and you know, you put it in your pocket and you shake it up and then you shake it up a little more and you shake it up a little more. And like the first shake didn't do anything, but when you're just layering it on top of each other, then you can see a kid whose behavior, it just explodes out of nowhere because it's been building and building and building. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so let's go into avoider a little bit. So your avoider is the one, they're probably not your huggers. They're probably not your touchers. They probably don't like messy play. They probably are like avoiding loud places or crowds. They might actually kind of like sometimes when you're an avoider of sensory input, it can look like you're shy or anxious, and it can then cause anxiety because you're trying to avoid that at all cost.
Mm-hmm. And don't have the words to use it. So you're kind of.
Yep. Yeah. And you don't know why. You don't know why it's bothering you. You just are like, that bothers me. My husband, I told you that he can go to like 3 stores. Well, he has super sensitive ears and he was a musician, and growing up, he just always said mad, 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 and he'd cross his arms, and his parents just kind of let him be mad, mad, mad. But we went to the fireworks the other night and he had to bring his special headphones that he wears now. My daughter had her special headphones on, and my stepfather said, well, I'm so confused. Like, why did he do that as a kid? And I'm like, same reason she's doing it now. Like her ears are just super, like, they're over responsive. And so it's too much. They want to avoid it. They're hearing so much of it. They're paying attention to every sound. And so it really affects them more than it does us. And so sometimes a loud classroom or a loud environment, like you said earlier, group work, you might see kids' behavior get really out of control during group work. And it's not because they don't want to work with other kids or because they want to avoid the work. It's because it just is so overstimulating for mm-hmm. them that they can't focus on what's in front of them. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that this makes me think of is I go into a lot of 504 and IEP meetings, and I'm perpetually frustrated by the languaging they use on these documents. And I don't know enough to be dangerous, but I know enough to know a kid and look at some of these and be like, that doesn't make sense in this situation, or it's not clear enough. So one of the common ones I see a lot is preferential seating. Mm. And it'll just say preferential seating. Mm-hmm. And so that's subject to so much interpretation. Does that mean closer to the teacher in the front of the room? Does that mean closer to the teacher's desk? Does that mean away from certain students that are distracting? Does that mean that visual things are too much for them, or auditory things are too, you can sit a kid right in front of the teacher, right in the center, where now they have stimulus on all sides of them, and the guinea pig's right there, and all the scratching and movement of it, they're always, mm-hmm. Getting that sensory in anyhow. So this is such an area that, again, is so under the iceberg, but impacts us so much.
Yeah. And it's seen as, and I hear so often, well, my kid doesn't have sensory processing disorder, so then it's just forgotten about. And it's like, no, we all have sensory preferences and needs. So we have to figure out how to get this more, widespread.
So what's the difference between sensory processing disorder and not an actual disorder, and even the word disorder, but we're not going to go there. Right. But for the person watching, if it's a disorder or it's just a sensory need and preference.
Yeah.
And so, do you distinguish between need and preference in your brain? Do we want to know that? Or is
I think it's just that we all have sensory, preferences means things that I like, things that I prefer. Need is something that I'm like, I need this to be happy and to be successful. Does that make sense? That's kind of,
yes. So kind of how I was talking about before, that threshold where it's not over or under.
Yeah.
Then that it's a preference. If it's like good enough in that gray area, it's a need if it exceeds that.
Kind of. Yeah. It's just knowing where your thresholds are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sensory processing disorder is that it's affecting more than just one area, and it debilitates your day-to-day life.
More than one sensory area?
Yeah, more than just one sensory area, and it's debilitating your day-to-day life. So meaning that, you struggle in school, you struggle with social cues, you struggle with eating, you struggle with, putting things in your mouth that are no longer safe. You have no... you don't have like the impulse control to realize what's safe and not safe. So you run out into the street because you're just seeking that movement and that, my son, when he was younger, like I had to be a vigilante on the playground. I was just telling someone about this the other day. Like I had to just hover over him. And I was so afraid of being considered a helicopter mom. Right. But when he was in first grade, he was at the top of the slide and he just was so excited to go down the slide. He went like this and he pushed his brother off the slide. And if another adult hadn't been there to just swoop up and catch my other son, he would have just fallen to the ground. And my son would have felt awful about it. It wasn't because he was mad. It wasn't because he didn't care about his brother. It wasn't because he was being manipulative or he was trying to get his way. He wasn't throwing a tantrum. He just had no awareness of his body.
Yeah. He was seeking and no awareness.
No.
And he was impulsive, meaning with executive function. He didn't have a long enough pause to say, let's evaluate the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's gotten better over time. But as a young one, I mean, it was really, really hard, and we focus on that a lot, on that pause. And he's 14, and we still have to focus on that pause because he's done things. And then afterwards, I know he's going to feel awful about it because he just didn't even, his intention was never to hurt someone else. Mm-hmm.
So, I just had a thought that I'm not going to go into right now, but okay. So we have done a couple of definitions about some key concepts. Let's back up a little bit and look at, you have a new family. Where do they start? Just things that you haven't mentioned so far. Where do they start?
Sensory.
Yeah. When they're saying, you know what, I can tell my kid, they're either they're seeking a lot or they're avoiding a lot. I can tell that something is impacting my child. How do
So I think a good place to start is just like a general checklist. So just doing observation and just watching your child and doing just a quick checklist. We have some on our Sensory Processing 101 site that I can link you to later. And just free checklist of just like, puts his fingers in his mouth, like does this. And then if it's like all yeses and you feel like it's taking over your child's life, like then I would take that to your general pediatrician, which a lot of times they don't know anything about it. So you'll have to ask for like an OT referral, which is an occupational therapist referral, because you can have your kid do therapy and you can do it at home too, which is, but it definitely helps if you have that full makeup, especially if it is teetering on the side of like debilitating their day-to-day life.
And what's the purpose of the occupational therapist?
So the occupational therapist can work on different exercises, such as, doing sensory bends or sensory activities, jumping, or, just really helping get that sensory input that your child needs or doesn't need and helping change that threshold that your child's at. So they'll do swinging, they'll do jumping. A lot of times they'll do body socks, which is like just wrapping up in like a compression. And you'll just learn a lot more about how you can help your child get that input. So if you don't go OT though, you can still, start on your own, like with just connection stuff. So if your child is constantly moving, then incorporate some fun movement activities before you need them to do a seated activity. So, and just remembering that behavior, they're not doing it to be wild and crazy or disrespectful. So when you say stop jumping on the couch and they keep doing it, that's not defiance. That's them just trying to get that need met. So, okay, how can I get that need met without them still jumping on the couch and ruining my couch? So it might be like a trampoline.
So what do you think about schools that are having less and less recess?
I'm sorry.
Because I bet that has a huge impact on
absolutely
developing their thresholds.
Yeah. Probably. I don't know if it actually, switched over. I just did a big thumbs down in case it didn't, like the video didn't switch over. But yeah, like it has a huge, then there's so much research. There's so much modern day research that shows the effects of recess and play for our kids. And not ending at second grade, third grade, but, going all the way up into the high school years and letting them have time to move around and to get that input that they need. I mean, absolutely. So if you don't have that, if your schools are getting less and less, then I would encourage you to speak up and to advocate for your kid to get movement. So maybe they become the person that takes the bucket of books to the library once a day, or they're the ones that are taking the chairs off and on the desk, or they're washing the screens, like the whiteboards or whatever, and you don't want it to be manual labor and your kids don't like it, but if they want to help, that's a great way to give them input while at school. So then you're serving two purposes.
And one thing that I do, and I'm sure you do as well, is I'm communicating with my kids about this stuff. So I need to help them connect the dots. So if I say to one of my students, hey, do you want to help me with this? Not because I need the help, but because this will actually help. Well, or maybe I do, but whatever. I'm just honest with them.
Yes.
I'm like, but I'm noticing these sensory things or this might help. Let's experiment. Mm-hmm. So I have open and honest conversations about this stuff too.
Absolutely.
Connect the dots so that they can be self-advocating or making their own choices and like noticing when I'm not there, their parents aren't there, their teachers aren't there, noticing, oh, I'm having that need again. Or
yeah. That empowerment piece is so huge. If we don't teach our kids you know, why we're giving them a tool that we're giving them, then we can't expect them to use it on their own.
All right. So as far as definitions, are there other key words or phrases or concepts that
you would say? The one that gets missed a lot in sensory processing would be the interoceptive sense. And I still struggle to get that word out.
Now, is that one of the 21?
Yeah. So it's the one of the,
I knew there were
it's one of the main eight. It's one of the main eight, actually.
Okay. So yeah. I knew the five and then the proprioception and the vestibular.
Mm-hmm. Now, interoceptive is
interoceptive.
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 Yes. Yes. I'll type it out for you afterwards. But it is basically your internal cues. So we're here talking about executive functions and we're talking about impulse control. If you can't recognize your internal cues, then you're going to have a really hard time having that impulse control. So
you're just going to react.
You're just going to react. You're just boop. There's no pause time, like you were saying. But it also comes down to being able to recognize that you need to go to the bathroom, being able to recognize that you're hungry or you're thirsty or you're tired. And so you'll get kids who are like getting really moving and antsy. And it's not necessarily that they need movement. It's that they're tired and don't even recognize it.
So it sounds to me like there's A, that sense, but there's B, that awareness of that sense. Can you help me understand that?
Well, I think if you're under responsive with your interoceptive sense, then you're going to not notice when, like my son does not know he has to go to the bathroom. He doesn't have any accidents or
until
anything
last
like that.
Second. He's just but like
his last second, urgency. Like, oh my gosh, I have to go. And he's 14. And we'll see a change in behavior. And so it's one of the first things we do for him when we notice a change in behaviors is we'll say, hey, when was the last time you went to the bathroom? And he'll double check and he'll go, yep, I'll go do that. And he'll go do that. And if that doesn't settle it, there's probably something else going on. But that's one of the first things we check.
That's great, so, because that seems like a tool that you can apply into all kinds of situations. Hey, did you, whatever the sensory need is.
Yep.
But you're bringing into their awareness, their conscious awareness, something that they're just not, and you're hardly even saying anything, but you're essentially creating the pause
mm-hmm.
for them.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just, we do that on like a pretty regular basis of, you know, like, hey, well, I'm wondering
you're
if
talking
it's too
about
loud.
The,
yeah.
You're
like talking, just bringing it to awareness.
You're talking about the ones who don't notice. And then you were going to go the other direction.
Well, with interoceptive, when it's over-responsive, I don't know what that looks like, okay. Except for it could look like a very sensitive child. It could, that's my guess. I don't know enough research on that. So I've done a lot of looking at and digging into when it's not there, because that's what I've had to deal with. But I would be curious to look at what happens if it's really in tune, because my guess is those are your empaths. Those are your like super intuitive kids who are really into their cues, but they don't, their recognizing of their internal cues is so high, but their communication skills might not be there yet.
I wonder if those are also some of the kids who take on other people's stuff too much and then grow up and have to really learn how to set mm-hmm. boundaries and at a big level. All mm-hmm. right. So one concept that you said that people skip a lot is the interoceptive.
Mm-hmm.
They all end with septive, proprioceptive, no vestibular sense. Well, okay. Forget that.
No, they're not all, but some do.
Okay. And that's the main eight out of 21 or so. Is there anything else notable in those?
No.
For now.
Yeah. Some of them are ones that like help your heart go and help you breathe and things like that. Like they're just part of your everyday life. So, I don't know all those, right? The main eight are the one you use on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. I have a very definite question for you. That's important, but are there other models, concepts, vocabulary that you want to make sure to get in?
As it relates to executive functioning and sensory, I don't think so.
So when you are, I'm assuming you deal with families more or less with younger kids. No. When you get into the middle school level and you have a kid and you're working with them, one of the things about middle school kids, they don't want to look different from anybody else. So if you were to say, hey, let's put these headphones on, and they weren't cool in any way, they would rather suffer and not think about it and pretend it's not there and pretend you're annoying. And then, so what do you do with kids who are in that middle school age who don't want to look different, and you're trying to help them? Are there any big things that come to mind with?
Yeah. So one of them is empowerment, right? We talked about that ownership piece and problem solving with them and helping them be self-aware. And so the more that I've been doing that in middle school, like I have a middle schooler right now, and he has a IEP because we think it's some sort of like dyslexia. So he really struggles with a lot of his executive functioning skills and getting started and planning and all of that. But he is your like star student otherwise. Like, he participates, he's quiet, he's helpful. He like, you know, he's the kid that all the teachers want to help. Whereas my other one is the kid that all the teachers are like, "Whoa, what's going on with him?" But they'll do that preferential seating thing like you talked about. And one of the things that was happening is they put him in the front row. Well, the door's open and he's paying attention to the stuff outside. So we had to really talk about, okay, where can you sit that you like to sit that's not going to draw you out? So it's doing or draw attention to you. So having that, just being really open and honest with them and having that conversation with them of, I'm noticing that you struggle with this. And I know that there's some solutions to it, but I also know, I totally hear you that you don't want to stand out. So let's play with some things at home that could maybe get you that same exact input without making you stand out. So that would be one way. That's like the least restrictive way. But honestly, I really try to help my kids advocate for themselves and recognize that our brains work differently and that we all have different needs and wants, and we all have different preferences of what helps us work. You know, like the whole time we've been talking here, I've had a fidget in my hand. And if I don't have a fidget in my hand, it is hard for me to focus and, you know, pay attention to what you're talking about and not squirrel away when you're talking, because I could be thinking of a bunch of different things. And so that's a tool I've learned that will keep me sane, and other people might not understand it. So I just try to teach my kids that as much as possible. And then third is helping them find things that all the kids in the class might like. So that's like bringing in cushions that maybe the whole class would like. Or when I go to meet the teachers, I say, hey, my kid really does well with fidgets. I know they become toys, but I'd love to donate a whole fidget box so you have enough for the whole class, because I don't want my kid to feel like he's being singled out when you hand him something. Because my kid can sit there with putty all day long and it helps him focus. Mm-hmm. But if he doesn't have the putty, if he doesn't have something in his hand, then he starts drifting off. So as the parent, I like to try to advocate for the whole class. So can I get you cushions for your room? Can I get you, you know, more seating for your room so that when my kid chooses the bouncy seat, he's not the only one in a bouncy seat.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, for parents who are watching, because I'm sure there's a bunch of parents watching right now that are going, oh my gosh, that was me as a kid. Do you hear that a lot from
people? I hear that a ton. And then I myself, all of my students call me an adult super kid. And the more that I learn about all the things that are under the surface, I'm like, yes, that's why I struggled to fit in growing up.
So what do you find yourself always saying to those parents when they say that to you? Dana, I'm that kid. What do I do? What wisdom do you want to share with us?
So when adults have that aha moment, it's the best thing that can happen, because now they can have so much more empathy for the kids that are in front of them that are struggling, and they can say, okay, wait a second, I can look at this with a totally different lens, because now I'm starting to understand the things I used to struggle with and maybe still do. And I can start using some of these tools to see if they help me. And I can start really empathizing with my child because now I get it. And I used to just think like, this is the thing I didn't love about myself. There's a scene. Are you a Marvel person?
I'm not either. I'm a hero person. I love Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey, but I'm not.
Yeah. So my son is a Marvel person and it's one of his like focuses. And he's made me watch all of the Infinity War stuff. And in Endgame, the very last one, they're all sitting around. This is not a spoiler for anyone that hasn't watched it and wants to. I don't think so. But they're sitting around at a cafe and they're all looking at Hulk and they've got this really funny look on their face. And they turn to him, the camera pans to him, and he's got Bruce Banner's face, but he's Hulk. And they're all looking at him funny, and he's like, yeah, so I've been trying to treat Hulk like a disease, something to get rid of. And I realized that when I combine the brawn of Hulk and the brains of Bruce Banner, I get to be my best self. And I'm like sitting crying in Endgame. I'm like, yes, this is it. Like the reason I brought that up is because I think that's what happens when adults realize that this was them like growing up. Like that's why I love listening to everything you have to offer because it helps me so much. I am a twice exceptional person. Like I know that I, you know, was gifted growing up and which would obviously make me still gifted. And then I definitely still struggled a ton with sensory stuff and with executive functions. And I think if I could have been diagnosed as a kid, I would have been diagnosed with ADHD. You even said it one day to me when we were doing something, you know, and it's just helped me realize there's nothing wrong with me and I'm not broken. And it helps me empathize with all the kids that I come in contact with.
Awesome. Now, when you get the parent or the adult who is like, I don't get it. They do need to try harder. This, you know, it's, you know, so what? They have a little sensory stuff. Deal with it. Figure it out. You know, and they don't experience the world in that way. What wisdom do you have for them?
So usually those are the ones that say, I struggled, but I turned out okay. So they need to get over it. And what we know now with research is that, yeah, you probably did okay, but there's one of two things. You did okay because you were going to do okay despite whatever happened to you, right? Whatever type of punishment was given to you or whatever type of conformity was, you know, put on you, or you conformed to a certain personality type. And so to compensate. So you either, you just kind of accept what people around you ask you to do, and so then you don't actually speak up for the things you really want or need in life, or you are a very strong personality because you stand up for what you want and need. And you've just found your way to find jobs where that's acceptable and social situations where that's acceptable. And so without even realizing it, you've crafted a world where you fit in it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times adults don't realize that they've crafted this world where they suddenly fit or they have conformed to the world. And so I like to present that aspect to them. And then also I like to, you know, I say you can try it. Honestly, like that's what I'll tell some people is if they're that adamant, I'll say, go try it. Because I did. I had the years of education behind me. I had all the research that I had read. I had all the books I had read. And I had advocates that we had paid tons of money for, therapists we had paid tons of money for. And it finally, I was just like, fine, I'll try anything. So I'll try timeouts. I'll try punishments. I'll try spanking, you know, and I'm ashamed to say it, but I did. And none of it worked. So like, if none of that worked, like why go down that route that just disconnects more? Like why not try a route that empathizes more and helps the kid become who they are and advocate for themselves?
Yeah. And one of the things that I think of is one of the tools that I use a lot myself, and I teach parents this, but is wait time. So if you're a parent, you're like, I don't get it. First of all, the checklist that Dana was talking about, you might look at that checklist really carefully and really watch your kid. And for the parent who they can watch your kid and check it off real quick, you spend three times as much time watching and attuning and really not saying a word and watching. I think that's something for me as an educator over 20 plus years, like I've crafted and worked very hard to watch and wait. And the other thing for parents with wait time, if you don't get it, is to ask your kid, what's going on with this? And then wait. And then when your kid answers you nothing or gives you a short answer or whatever, say, tell me more, or just wait and create an awkward silence to give them space. So often as adults, we expect an answer so quick, and we're in such a quick world. And I think it's really important to slow down, put the brakes on, go from 60 miles an hour to 5 or 2 and be like, whoa, tell me about what's going on. Because I will tell you, Dan, and you probably know this too, but when I'm working with kids, sometimes I might be trying to communicate with them for 10 or 15 minutes before I get that nugget I need to know how to help them. And it's so much of asking questions and being genuinely curious and giving the space, what you said at the beginning, connection, right? Giving the emotional safe space. And if that's not language that you, the viewer, have heard a lot in our families growing up or our communities, like, that create holding space, learning to really listen so that they can feel like this. Here's how I explain it. The kid goes, that person's not really listening to me. Now they're not doing this consciously, but the kid's like, yeah, I'm just going to give them the answer they want, or I'll just, you know, whatever. And they're like, not really being listened to. For the kid to have that shift to be like, are they really listening? And then you're showing them you are. And then they can take a little risk, tell you a little more, and know they're not going to be judged. Know you're not just going to respond and tell them how they should be. Just hold space. But you have to do it over and over and over. Mm-hmm. You will see a change in your relationship where they will start to open up on levels that will help you help them so much.
Yeah, I love that. I think just listen to them, like you said. Like just trust that even though their answers might not make sense, they're trying to tell you what's going on.
Tell me more.
Just tell me more. So it makes me think of, we had this one student and her son, and they homeschool, and they were going to a homeschool co-op, and her son was really struggling in bells class, which is apparently like a music class where you stand and have to do different like bells, different size bells. And this kid was probably like 9, and the mom was like, I don't understand. He just says he's tired, but he's not tired. He slept well. He ate well. He's running around in the gym before. He's not tired. He just keeps saying he's tired. And then he's not doing bells, and he's getting sent to timeout, and it's over and over and over again. So I brought the kid on, and I was like, all right, so talk to me about bells. And I was assuming that he just didn't like bells, but I didn't want to like go in with that assumption. So I was like, all right, so talk to me about bells. He told me what it was. I was like, so tell me more about how it works. So he told me, and I'm like, do you like going to bells? And he was like, I love it. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I was like, totally shocked. So we dig and we dig and we dig. And he's like, I'm tired. And I'm like, okay, what do you mean when you say you're tired? He's like, my body is tired. Like my body can't stand up. And I'm like, oh, so does it feel like you just can't even hold your body up? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, can you tell me what you want to do instead? He's like, I just want to sit. Okay. What would happen if you asked to sit in bells? Well, we can't sit. We have to stand. Ah, therein lies the problem, right? So then just by continuing, like you said, to ask questions, he was tired. He had really low core strength. So he couldn't hold his body up. So together we worked back and forth and figured out a like stacked chair solution where we could stack a bunch of chairs and he could lean against the chair so he could still be standing and do his bells. He's never had a timeout since. He loves bells and he never gets in trouble. Like, just from that, like, one little tweak of a conversation. And I think that's what you're saying here is just like, one, hold space, and two, listen. And I went to like the snarky side of just fine, try it. But if you're giving an actual tip, that was a really good reminder.
Yeah. Yeah. And such a great story too. And I love like how you just have to keep digging and it's, and we want to hurry. We want it quick. We want it easy. And it's not, this stuff is messy. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. Mm-hmm. But the constraints of schools being like, oh, we need to cover this curriculum and we need to get through all this stuff. It's not about getting through stuff. Oh my God. Anyhow, I'm not going to go down that. So before I ask you the second last question, where I'm going to ask you about what they should do this week, is there anything you want to cover before we get to that?
No, I don't think so. I think we're covering a lot here. So. Yeah.
So the parents watching right now, they're like, all right, Dana, what do I do this week? Tell me something to do. How can I implement some of your teachings or learn from you more?
Well, one, finish watching this entire conference because I know that Seth has only brought on amazing people. So that's number one. And I'm going to be watching every single one. So that's one.
They're so good. Yeah. I'm loving it.
I can't wait. I can't wait to listen to all of them. So that is step one of what you can do this week while you're watching this. And number two is I do have a workshop coming up that you can sign up for. And I think Seth said it was okay that I tell you about that. So it starts September 5th, which is really soon. And I can't remember, like, I know we're recording this a little bit before.
You can link it in.
So I don't know exactly, but it's coming really soon. And that's at calmthechaosworkshop.com. So I would sign up for that because earlier we were talking about that journey of like, oh my gosh, this seems like so much to figure out. And that's what our framework does, is it explains that those three core pieces we were talking about connect, understand, empower. And we don't dive really deep into the sensory processing piece, but we do talk about that connection piece. We talk about how it all fits together. And I think that it'll be a great starting point. And then from there, you can just reach out and we've got stuff to help you. So I would say outside of listening to this and signing up for that is just connect with your kids. Like, just go and play with your kids, sit with your kids, listen to your kids, observe your kids, and start watching them from a different lens. That would be like I would be so excited if you wrote me and said, I started watching my kid differently. I would feel like that was a huge takeaway this week.
And from a sensory perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think.
Want to connect that dot.
Yes, your kids from that new lens of what's under the surface. What could be going on with this behavior that I may have blamed him for in the past or her for in the past? Like, what else could be under this?
Awesome. And then here's the last question. You ready? Okay. Uh-oh. From your heart to the heart of the parent right now that's really concerned about their kid and they're really worried. From your heart to the heart of the parents, what is the most important takeaway you hope people will leave with right now?
The most important takeaway is that you are not a bad parent and your kid is not broken. Neither one are true. It's just that you have been going under old ways of parenting, or you have been misinformed that there's other things under the surface, and you are in the perfect time now because you're surrounded by support. Seth has created this amazing support system here for you. So you are no longer alone anymore. You don't have to feel like you're a failure. You don't have to feel like your kid's broken. You don't have to feel like you're doing everything wrong, because you're not. And your kid is amazing and you're amazing. And together we are going to help you conquer each and every day.
So good. That's why I didn't tell you that question before.
I was so nervous.
Thanks so much.
I do love chatting with people, so that wasn't too bad.
All right. Well, thank you to Dana Abraham for coming out today and sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you. This has been so fun. I love chatting with you.
Awesome. And parents, go take action. We'll see you in the next one. Take care.
Bye.